Although I didn't agree with Mother's decision, I understood her feelings. Shortly before she took Daddy back, I went down to the courthouse and had my name changed legally from Blythe to Clinton, the name I had been using for years. I'm still not sure exactly why I did it. But I know I really thought I should, partly because Roger was about to start school, and I didn't want the differences in our lineage to ever be an issue for him, partly because I just wanted the same name as the rest of my family. Maybe I even wanted to do something nice for Daddy, though I was glad Mother had divorced him. I didn't tell her in advance, but she had to give her permission. When she got a call from the courthouse, she said, "Okay," though she probably thought I had slipped a gear. It wouldn't be the last time in my life that my decisions and my timing were open to question. The deterioration of my parents' marriage, the divorce and reconciliation, took up a lot of my emotional energy at the end of junior high and through my sophomore year in the old high school just up the hill. Just as Mother threw herself into work, I threw myself into high school and into my new neighborhood on Scully Street. It was a block full of mostly newer, modest houses. Just across the street was a completely empty square block, all that was left of the Wheatley Farm, which had covered a much larger area not long before. Every year, Mr. Wheatley planted the whole block with peonies. They brightened the spring and drew people from miles around who waited patiently for him to cut them and give them away. We lived in the second house on the street. The first house on the corner of Scully and Wheatley belonged to the Reverend Walter Yeldell and his wife Kay and their kids Carolyn, Linda, and Walter. Walter was pastor of Second Baptist Church and later president of the Arkansas Baptist Convention. He and Kay were wonderful to us from the first day. I don't know how Brother Yeldell, as we called him, who died in 1987, would have fared in the harshly judgmental environment of the Southern Baptist Convention of the 90s, when wrong-thinking liberals were purged from the seminaries and the church hardened its positions rightward on every social issue but race. It apologized for the sins of the past. Brother Yeldell was a big, broad man who weighed well over 250 pounds. Beneath a shy demeanor, he had a terrific sense of humor and a great laugh. So did his wife. They didn't have a pompous bone between them. He led people to Christ through instruction and example, not condemnation and ridicule. He wouldn't have been a favorite of some of the recent Baptist overlords or today's conservative talk show host. But I sure liked talking to him. Carolyn, the oldest Yeldell child, was my age. She loved music, had a wonderful voice, and was an accomplished pianist. We spent countless hours around her piano singing. She also accompanied my saxophone solos from time to time. Probably not the first time an accompanist was better than the soloist. Carolyn soon became one of my closest friends, and a part of our regular gang, along with David Leopoulos, Joe Newman, and Ronnie Cecil. We went to movies and school events together and spent lots of time playing cards and games or just goofing off, usually at our house. In 1963, when I went to American Legion Boys Nation and took the now famous photo with President Kennedy, Carolyn was elected to Girls Nation, the only time that ever happened to hometown neighbors. Carolyn went to the University of Indiana and studied voice. She wanted to be an opera singer, but didn't want the lifestyle. Instead, she married Jerry Staley, a fine photographer, had three kids, and became a leader in the field of adult literacy. When I became governor, I put her in charge of our adult literacy program, and she and her family lived in a great old house about three blocks from the governor's mansion, where I often visited for parties, games, or singing the way we did in the old days. When I became president, Carolyn and her family moved to the Washington area, where she went to work for and later led the National Institute for Literacy. She stayed on for a while after I left the White House, then followed her father into the ministry. The Staleys are still a good part of my life. It all started on Scully Street. The house on the other side of us belonged to Jim and Edith Clark, who had no kids of their own but treated me like theirs. Among other neighbors were the Frasers, an older couple who always supported me when I got into politics. But their greatest gift to me came by accident. Over the holidays in 1974, after I lost a heartbreaking race for Congress and was feeling pretty low, I saw the Frasers' little granddaughter, who must have been 5 or 6. She had a severe medical condition that made her bones weak and was in a body cast up to her chest that also splayed her legs outward to take the pressure off her spine. It was very awkward for her to navigate with her crutches. But she was a tough little girl with that total lack of self-consciousness that secure young children have. When I saw her, I asked her if she knew who I was. She said, "Sure, you're still Bill Clinton." I needed to be reminded of that just then. The Hassins, the Syrian-Italian family I mentioned earlier, were packed, all 6 of them, in a tiny house at the end of the street. They must have spent all their money on food. Every Christmas, and on several other occasions during the year, they fed the whole block huge Italian meals. I can still hear Mama Gina saying, Abil, you gotta eat some more. And then there were John and Tony Carber, who were both book readers and the most intellectual people I knew, and their son Mike, who was in my class. And Charlie Housley, a man's man who knew about hunting and fishing and fixing things, the things that matter to small boys, who took Roger under his wing. Though our new house and yard were smaller than our old one, and the immediate surroundings were less beautiful, I came to love my new home and neighborhood. It was a good place for me to live out my high school years. Chapter 7. High school was a great ride. I liked the schoolwork, my friends, the band, Demolay, and my other activities. But it bothered me that Hot Spring schools still weren't integrated. The black kids still went to Langston High School, which claimed as its most famous alumnus the legendary Washington Redskins back, Bobby Mitchell. I followed the civil rights movement on the evening news and in our daily paper, the Sentinel Record, along with Cold War events like the Bay of Pigs and the U-2 incident with Francis Gary Powers. I can still see Castro riding into Havana at the head of his ragtag but victorious army. But as with most kids, politics took a back seat to daily life, and apart from Daddy's occasional relapses, I liked my life a lot. It was in high school that I really fell in love with music. Classical, jazz, and band music joined rock and roll, swing, and gospel as my idea of pure joy. For some reason, I didn't get into country and western until I was in my 20s when Hank Williams and Patsy Cline reached down to me from heaven. In addition to the marching and concert bands, I joined our dance band, the Stardusters. I spent a year dueling for first chair on tenor sax with Larry McDougall, who looked as if he should have played backup for Buddy Holly, the rocker who died tragically in a bad weather plane crash in 1959, along with 2 other big stars, the Big Bopper and 17-year-old Richie Valens. When I was president, I gave a speech to college students in Mason City, Iowa, near where Holly and his pals had played their last gig. Afterward, I drove to the site, the Surf Ballroom in neighboring Clear Lake, Iowa. It's still standing and ought to be turned into a shrine for those of us who grew up on those guys. Anyway, McDougall looked and played as if he belonged with them. He had a ducktail hairdo, crew cut on top, long hair greased back on the sides. When he stood for a solo, he gyrated and played with a blaring tone, more like hardcore rock and roll than jazz or swing. I wasn't as good as he was in 1961, but I was determined to get better. That year, we entered a competition with other jazz bands in Camden, in South Arkansas. I had a small solo on a slow, pretty piece. At the end of the performance, to my astonishment, I won the prize for Best Sweet Soloist. By the next year, I had improved enough to be first chair in the All-State Band, a position I won again as a senior when Joe Newman won on drums. In my last 2 years, I played in a jazz trio, The Three Kings, with Randy Goodrum, a pianist a year younger and light years better than I was or ever could be. Our first drummer was Mike Hardgraves. Mike was raised by a single mom, who often had me and a couple of Mike's other friends over for card games. In my senior year, Joe Newman became our drummer. We made a little money playing for dances, and we performed at school events, including the annual band variety show. Our signature piece was the theme from El Cid. I still have a tape of it, and it holds up pretty well after all these years, except for a squeak I made in my closing riff. I always had problems with the lower notes. My band director, Virgil Sperlin, was a tall, heavyset man with dark, wavy hair and a gentle, winning demeanor. He was a pretty good band director and a world-class human being. Mr. Sperlin also organized the State Band Festival, which was held over several days every year in Hot Springs. He had to schedule all the band performances and hundreds of solo and ensemble presentations in classrooms in the junior and senior high school buildings. He scheduled the days, times, and venues for all the events on large poster boards every year. Those of us who were willing stayed after school and worked nights for several days to help him get the job done. It was the first large organizational effort in which I was ever involved, and I learned a lot that I put to good use later on. At the state festivals, I won several medals for solos and ensembles, and a couple for student conducting, of which I was especially proud. I loved to read the scores and try to get the band to play pieces exactly as I thought they should sound. In my second term as president, Leonard Slatkin, conductor of the Washington National Symphony, asked me if I would direct the orchestra in Sousa's Stars and Stripes Forever at the Kennedy Center. He told me all I had to do was wave the baton more or less in time, and the musicians would do the rest. He even offered to bring me a baton and show me how to hold it. When I told him that I'd be delighted to do it, but that I wanted him to send me the score of the march so I could review it, he almost dropped the phone. But he brought the score and the baton. When I stood before the orchestra, I was nervous, but we got into it, and away we went. I hope Mr. Sousa would have been pleased. My only other artistic endeavor in high school was the junior class play, Arsenic and Old Lace, a hilarious farce about two old maids who poison people and stash them in the house they share with their unsuspecting nephew. I got the role of the nephew, which Cary Grant played in the movie. My girlfriend was played by a tall, attractive girl, Cindy Arnold. The play was a big success, largely because of two developments that weren't part of the script. In one scene, I was supposed to lift up a window seat, find one of my aunt's victims, and feign horror. I practiced hard and had it down. But on play night, when I opened the seat, my friend Ronnie Cecil was crammed into it, looked up at me, and said, "Good evening," in his best vampire voice. I lost it. Luckily, so did everyone else. Something even funnier happened offstage. When I kissed Cindy during our only love scene, her boyfriend, a senior football player named Alan Broyles, who was sitting in the front row, let out a loud comic groan that brought the house down. I still enjoyed the kiss. My high school offered calculus and trigonometry, chemistry and physics, Spanish, French, and 4 years of Latin, a range of courses many smaller schools in Arkansas lacked. We were blessed with a lot of smart, effective teachers and a remarkable school leader, Johnny Mae Mackey, a tall, imposing woman with thick black hair and a ready smile or a stern scowl as the occasion demanded. Johnny Mae ran a tight ship and still managed to be the spark plug of our school spirit, which was a job in itself, because we had the losingest football team in Arkansas back when football was a religion, with every coach expected to be Newt Rockne. Every student from back then can still remember Johnny Mae closing our pep rallies, leading the Trojan yell, fist in the air, dignity discarded, voice roaring, "Hullabaloo, key neck, key neck, hullabaloo, key neck, key neck, woo-hee, woo-hi, we win or die. Ching-chang, chow-chow, bing-bang, bow-wow, Trojans, Trojans, fight, fight, fight." Fortunately, it was just a cheer. With a 29-1 record in my 3 years. If the yell had been accurate, our mortality rate would have been serious. I took 4 years of Latin from Mrs. Elizabeth Buck, a delightful, sophisticated woman from Philadelphia who had us memorize lots of lines from Caesar's Gallic Wars. After the Russians beat us into space with Sputnik, President Eisenhower and then President Kennedy decided Americans needed to know more about science and math, so I took all the courses I could. I was not very good in Dick Duncan's chemistry class, but did better in biology, though I remember only one remarkable class in which the teacher, Nathan McCauley, told us we die sooner than we should because our body's capacity to turn food into energy and process the waste wears out. In 2002, a major medical study concluded that older people could increase their lifespan dramatically by sharply decreasing food intake. Coach McCauley knew that 40 years ago. Now that I am one of those older people, I am trying to take his advice. My world history teacher, Paul Root, was a short, stocky man from rural Arkansas who combined a fine mind with a homespun manner and an offbeat, wicked sense of humor. When I became governor, he left his teaching position at Ouachita University to work for me. One day in 1987, I came upon Paul in the state capitol talking to three state legislators. They were discussing Gary Hart's recent downfall after the story broke about Donna Rice and the monkey business. The legislators were all giving Gary hell in their most sanctimonious voices. Paul, a devout Baptist, director of his church choir, and a certified straight arrow, listened patiently while the legislators droned on. When they stopped for breath, he deadpanned, "You're absolutely right. What he did was awful. But you know what else? It's amazing what being short, fat, and ugly has done for my moral character." The legislators shut up, and Paul walked off with me. I love that guy. I enjoyed all my English courses. John Wilson made Shakespeare's Julius Caesar come alive to Arkansas 15-year-olds by having us put the meaning of the play in ordinary words and asking us repeatedly whether Shakespeare's view of human nature and behavior seemed right to us. Mr. Wilson thought old Will had it about right. Life is comedy and tragedy. In junior English honors class, we had to write an autobiographical essay. Mine was full of self-doubt I didn't understand and hadn't admitted to myself before. Here are some excerpts. "I am a person motivated and influenced by so many diverse forces, I sometimes question the sanity of my existence. I am a living paradox, deeply religious, yet not as convinced of my exact beliefs as I ought to be, wanting responsibility yet shirking it, loving the truth, but oftentimes giving way to falsity. I detest selfishness, but see it in the mirror every day. I view those, some of whom are very dear to me, who have never learned how to live. I desire and struggle to be different from them, but often am almost an exact likeness. What a boring little word, I, me, my, mine. The only things that enable worthwhile uses of these words are the universal good qualities which we are not too often able to place with them. Faith, trust, love, responsibility, regret, knowledge. But the acronyms to these symbols of what enable life to be worth the trouble cannot be escaped. I, in my attempts to be honest, will not be the hypocrite I hate, and will own up to their ominous presence in this boy endeavoring in such earnest to be a man." My teacher, Lonnie Warnecki, gave me a grade of 100, saying the paper was a beautiful and honest attempt to go way down inside to fulfill the classic demand to know thyself. I was gratified but still unsure of what to make of what I'd found. I didn't do bad things. I didn't drink, smoke, or go beyond petting with girls, though I kissed a fair number. Most of the time I was happy, but I could never be sure I was as good as I wanted to be. Miss Warnecke took our small class on a field trip to Newton County, my first trip into the heart of the Ozarks in North Arkansas, our Appalachia. Back then, it was a place of breathtaking beauty, hardscrabble poverty, and rough, all-consuming politics. The county had about 6,000 people spread over more than a couple of hundred square miles in hills and hollows. Jasper, the county seat, had a little more than 300 people, a WPA-built courthouse, two cafes, a general store, and one tiny movie theater, where our class went one night to watch an old Audie Murphy western. When I got into politics, I came to know every township in Newton County, but I fell in love with it at 16 as we navigated the mountain roads, learning about the history, geology, flora, and fauna of the Ozarks. One day we visited the cabin of a mountain man who had a collection of rifles and pistols dating back to the Civil War, then explored a cave the Confederates had used for munition storage. The guns still fired, and remnants of the arsenal were still in the cave, visible manifestation of how real a century-old conflict was in places where time passed slowly, grudges died hard, and handed-down memories hung on and on. In the mid-70s, when I was Attorney General, I was invited to give the commencement address at Jasper High School. I urged the students to keep going in the face of adversity, citing Abraham Lincoln and all the hardships and setbacks he had overcome. Afterward, the leading Democrats took me out into a bright, starlit Ozark night and said, "Bill, that was a fine speech. You can give it down in Little Rock anytime. But don't you ever come up here and brag on that Republican president again. If he had been that good, we wouldn't have had the Civil War." I didn't know what to say. In Ruth Sweeney's senior English class, we read Macbeth and were encouraged to memorize and recite portions of it. I made it through 100 lines or so, including the famous soliloquy that begins, "Tomorrow and tomorrow, and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day to the last syllable of recorded time," and ends, "Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing." Almost 30 years later, when I was governor, I happened to visit a class in Valonia, Arkansas, on a day the students were studying Macbeth, and I recited the lines for them, the words still full of power for me, a dreadful message I was always determined would not be the measure of my life. The summer after my junior year, I attended the annual week-long American Legion Boys State program at Camp Robinson, an old army camp with enough primitive wooden barracks to house 1,000 16-year-old boys. We were organized by cities and counties, divided equally into two political parties, and introduced as candidates and voters to local, county, and state politics. We also developed platforms and voted on issues. We heard addresses from important figures from the governor on down and got to spend one day at the state capitol, during which the boy state governor, the other elected officials and their staffs, and the legislators actually got to occupy the state offices and legislative chambers. At the end of the week, both parties nominated two candidates for the Boys Nation program, to be held toward the end of July at the University of Maryland in College Park, near the nation's capital. An election was held, and the top two vote-getters got to go as Arkansas senators. I was one of them. I went to Camp Robinson wanting to run for Boys Nation senator. Though the most prestigious post was governor, I had no interest in it then, or in the real job itself, for years thereafter. I thought Washington was where the action was on civil rights, poverty, education, and foreign policy. Besides, I couldn't have won the governor's election anyway, since it was, in the Arkansas vernacular, saucered and blowed, over before it started. My longtime friend from Hope, Mac McClarty, had it in the bag. As his school's student council president, a star quarterback, and a straight-A student, He had begun lining up support all across the state several weeks earlier. Our party nominated Larry Taunton, a radio announcer with a wonderful silken voice full of sincerity and confidence, but McLarty had the votes and won going away. We were all sure he would be the first person our age to be elected governor, an impression reinforced 4 years later when he was elected student body president at the University of Arkansas, and again just a year after that, when at 22, he became the youngest member of the state legislature. Not long after that, Mac, who was in the Ford business with his father, devised a then-novel leasing scheme for Ford trucks, which eventually made him and Ford Motor Company a fortune. He gave up politics for a business career that led him to the presidency of Arkansas-Louisiana Gas Company, our largest natural gas utility. But he stayed active in politics, lending leadership and fundraising skills to many Arkansas Democrats, especially David Pryor and me. He stayed with me all the way to the White House, first as chief of staff, then as special envoy to the Americas. Now he is Henry Kissinger's partner in a consulting business and owns, among other things, 12 car dealerships in Sao Paulo, Brazil. Though he lost the governor's race, Larry Taunton got a big consolation prize. As the only boy besides McLarty with 100% name recognition, he was a lock cinch for one of the two Boys Nation slots. He had only to file. But there was a problem. Larry was one of two stars in his hometown delegation. The other was Bill Rainier, a bright, handsome, multi-sport athlete. They had come to Boys State agreeing that Taunton would run for governor, Rainier for Boys Nation. Now, though both were free to run for Boys Nation, there was no way two boys from the same town were going to be elected. Besides, they were both in my party, and I had been campaigning hard for a week. A letter I wrote to Mother at the time recounts that I had already won elections for tax collector, party secretary, and municipal judge, and that I was running for county judge, an important position in real Arkansas politics. At the last minute, not long before the party met to hear our campaign speeches, Taunton filed. Bill Rainier was so stunned he could hardly get through his speech. I still have a copy of my own speech, which is unremarkable, except for a reference to the Little Rock Central High turmoil. We have grown up in a state ridden with the shame of a crisis it did not ask for. I did not approve of what Faubus had done, and I wanted people from other states to think better of Arkansas. When the votes were counted, Larry Taunton finished first by a good margin. I was second with a pretty good cushion. Rainier finished well back. I had come to really like Bill, and I never forgot the dignity with which he bore his loss. In 1992, when Bill was living in Connecticut, he contacted my campaign and offered to help. Our friendship, forged in the pain of youthful disappointment, enjoyed a happy renewal. Larry Taunton and I defeated our opponents from the other party after another day of campaigning, and I arrived in College Park on July 19, 1963, and eager to meet the other delegates, vote on important issues, hear from cabinet members and other government officials, and visit the White House, where we hoped to see the president. The week passed quickly, the days packed with events and legislative sessions. I remember being particularly impressed by Secretary of Labor Willard Wirtz and completely caught up in our debates over civil rights. Many of the boys were Republicans and supporters of Barry Goldwater, who they hoped would defeat President Kennedy in 1964. But there were enough progressives on civil rights, including four of us from the South, for our legislative proposals to carry the day. Because of my friendship with Bill Rainier and my more liberal views on civil rights, I had a tense relationship with Larry Taunton the whole week of Boys Nation. I'm glad that after I became president, I got to meet the grown-up Larry Taunton and his children. He seemed to be a good man who had built a good life. On Monday, July 22nd, we visited the Capitol, took pictures on the steps, and met our state senators. Larry and I had lunch with J. William Fulbright, chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and John McClellan, chairman of the Appropriations Committee. The seniority system was alive and well, and no state had more power from it than Arkansas. In addition, all four of our congressmen held important positions. Wilbur Mills was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, Orrin Harris, chairman of the Commerce Committee, Took Gathings, ranking member of the Agriculture Committee, and Jim Trimble, who had been in Congress only since 1945, a member of the powerful Rules Committee, which controls the flow of legislation to the House floor. Little did I know that within 3 years, I would be working for Fulbright on the Foreign Relations Committee staff. A few days after the lunch, Mother got a letter from Senator Fulbright saying that he had enjoyed our lunch and that she must be proud of me. I still have that letter, my first encounter with good staff work. On Wednesday, July 24th, we went to the White House to meet the President in the Rose Garden. President Kennedy walked out of the Oval Office into the bright sunshine and made some brief remarks, complimenting our work, especially our support for civil rights, and giving us higher marks than the governors, who had not been so forward-leaning in their annual summer meeting. After accepting a Boys Nation T-shirt, Kennedy walked down the steps and began shaking hands. I was in the front, and being bigger, and a bigger supporter of the president's than most of the others, I made sure I'd get to shake his hand, even if he shook only two or three. It was an amazing moment for me. Meeting the president, whom I had supported in my ninth grade class debates, and about whom I felt even more strongly after his 2.5 years in office. A friend took a photo for me, and later we found film footage of the handshake in the Kennedy Library. Much has been made of that brief encounter and its impact on my life. My mother said she knew when I came home that I was determined to go into politics, and after I became the Democratic nominee in 1992, the film was widely pointed to as the beginning of my presidential aspirations. I'm not sure about that. I have a copy of the speech I gave to the American Legion in Hot Springs after I came home, and in it I didn't make too much of the handshake. I thought at the time I wanted to become a senator, but deep down I probably felt as Abraham Lincoln did when he wrote as a young man, "I will study and get ready, and perhaps my chance will come." I had some success in high school politics, getting elected president of the junior class, and I wanted to run for president of the student council, but the accrediting group that oversaw our high school decided that Hot Springs students were not allowed to be involved in too many activities and ordered restrictions. Under the new rules, since I was the band major, I was ineligible to run for student council or class president. So was Phil Jamison, the captain of the football team and the odds-on favorite to win. Not running for high school student council president didn't hurt me or Phil Jamison too much. Phil went on to the Naval Academy, and after his naval career, he did important work in the Pentagon on arms control issues. When I was president, he was involved in all our important work with Russia, and our friendship gave me a close account of our efforts from an operational level, which I would not have received had I not known him. In one of the dumber political moves of my life, I allowed my name to be put up for senior class secretary by a friend who was angry about the new activity restrictions. My next-door neighbor, Carolyn Yeldell, defeated me handily, as she should have. It was a foolish, selfish thing for me to do, and proof positive of one of my rules of politics: never run for an office you don't really want and don't have a good reason to hold. Notwithstanding the setbacks, sometime in my 16th year, I decided I wanted to be in public life as an elected official. I loved music and thought I could be very good, but I knew I would never be John Coltrane or Stan Getz. I was interested in medicine and thought I could be a fine doctor, but I knew I would never be Michael DeBakey. But I knew I could be great in public service. I was fascinated by people, politics, and policy. And I thought I could make it without family wealth or connections or establishment Southern positions on race and other issues. Of course, it was improbable. But isn't that what America is all about? Chapter 8. One other memorable event happened to me in the summer of 1963. On August 28th, 9 days after I turned 17, I sat alone in a big white reclining chair in our den and watched the greatest speech of my lifetime as Martin Luther King Jr. stood in front of the Lincoln Memorial and spoke of his dream for America. In rhythmic cadences reminiscent of old Negro spirituals, his voice at once booming and shaking, he told a vast throng before him, and millions like me transfixed before television sets, of his dream that one day, on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood, and that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. It is difficult to convey more than 40 years later the emotion and hope with which King's speech filled me, or what it meant to a nation with no Civil Rights Act, no Voting Rights Act, no open housing law, no Thurgood Marshall on the Supreme Court, or what it meant in the American South, where schools were still mostly segregated, the poll tax was used to keep blacks from voting or to round them up to vote as a block for the status quo crowd, and the word nigger was still used openly by people who knew better. I started crying during the speech and wept for a good while after Dr. King finished. He had said everything I believed, far better than I ever could. More than anything I ever experienced, except perhaps the power of my grandfather's example, that speech steeled my determination to do whatever I could for the rest of my life to make Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream come true. A couple of weeks later, I started my senior year in high school, still on a high from Boys Nation and determined to enjoy my last shot at childhood. The most challenging course I took in high school was calculus. There were seven of us in the class. It had never been offered before. I recall two events with clarity. One day, the teacher, Mr. Coe, handed back an exam on which I had all the right answers, but a grade reflecting that I'd missed one. When I asked about it, Mr. Coe said I hadn't worked the problem properly and therefore must have gotten the correct answer by accident, so he couldn't give me credit for it. In the textbook, the problem required several more steps than I had used. Our class had one true genius, Jim McDougal, no, not the Whitewater one, who asked if he could see my paper. He then told Mr. Coe he should give me credit because my solution was as valid as the one in the textbook, indeed better because it was shorter. He then volunteered to demonstrate the validity of his opinion. Mr. Coe was just as much in awe of Jim's brain as the rest of us, so he told him to go ahead. Jim then proceeded to fill two full blackboards with symbolic mathematical formulas, analyzing the problem and demonstrating how I had improved on the textbook solution. You could have fooled me. I had always liked solving puzzles, still do. But I was just clawing my way through a maze. I didn't have a clue about what Jim was saying, and I'm not sure Mr. Coe did either. But at the end of his bravura performance, I got my grade changed. That incident taught me two things: that in problem solving, sometimes good instincts can overcome intellectual inadequacy, and that I had no business pursuing advanced mathematics any further. Our class met at fourth period just after lunch. On November 22nd, Mr. Coe was called out of class to the office. When he returned, he was white as a sheet and could hardly speak. He told us President Kennedy had been shot and probably killed in Dallas. I was devastated. Just 4 months before, I had seen him in the Rose Garden, so full of life and strength. So much of what he did and said, the inaugural address, the Alliance for Progress in Latin America, the cool handling of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the Peace Corps, the stunning line from the Ich bin ein Berliner speech, "Freedom has many difficulties, and democracy is not perfect, but we have never had to put a wall up to keep our people in." All these embodied my hopes for my country and my belief in politics. After class, all the students in the annex where our class met walked back to the main building. We were all so sad, all of us but one. I overheard an attractive girl who was in the band with me say that maybe it was a good thing for the country that he was gone. I knew her family was more conservative than I was, but I was stunned and very angry that someone I considered a friend would say such a thing. It was my first exposure, beyond raw racism, to the kind of hatred I would see a lot of in my political career, and that was forged into a powerful political movement in the last quarter of the 20th century. I am thankful that my friend outgrew it. When I was campaigning in Las Vegas in 1992, she came to one of my events. She had become a social worker and a Democrat. I treasured our reunion and the chance it gave me to heal an old wound. After I watched President Kennedy's funeral and was reassured by Lyndon Johnson's sober assumption of the presidency with the moving words, "All that I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today," I slowly returned to normal life. The rest of senior year passed quickly with demolay and band activities, including a senior band trip to Pensacola, Florida, and another trip to All-State Band, and lots of good times with my friends, including lunches at the Club Cafe with the best Dutch apple pie I've ever had, movies, dances at the Y, ice cream at Cook's Dairy, and barbecue at McLard's, a 75-year-old family place with arguably the best barbecue and unquestionably the best barbecue beans in the whole country. For several months of that year, I dated Susan Smithers, a girl from Benton, Arkansas, 30 miles east of Hot Springs on the highway to Little Rock. Often on Sundays, I would go to Benton to church and lunch with her family. At the end of the meal, Susan's mother, Mary, would put a pile of peach or apple-fried pies on the table, and her father, Reese, and I would eat them until I practically had to be carried away. One Sunday after lunch, Susan and I went for a drive to Bauxite, a town near Benton named for the ore used to make aluminum, which was dug out of open-pit mines there. When we got to town, we decided to drive out to see the mines, going off the road onto what I thought was hard clay soil, right up to the edge of a huge open pit. After walking around the site, we got back in the car to go home, and our mood took a sharp downward turn. My car's wheels had sunk deep into the soft, wet ground. The wheels turned over and over, but we didn't move an inch. I found some old boards, dug down behind the wheels, and put them in the space for traction. Still no luck. After 2 hours, I had burned all the tread off the tires. It was getting dark, and we were still stuck. Finally, I gave up, walked to town, asked for help, and called Susan's parents. Eventually, help came, and we were towed out of the huge ruts, my tires as smooth as a baby's behind. It was way past dark when I got Susan home. I think her folks believed our story, but her dad sneaked a look at my tires just to be sure. In that more innocent time, I was mortified. As my senior year drew to a close, I became increasingly anxious about college. For some reason, I never even considered applying to any Ivy League school. I knew just where I wanted to go, and I applied only there, the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. I didn't want to go into the Foreign Service, and I had never even seen the Georgetown campus when I was at Boys Nation, but I wanted to go back to Washington. Georgetown had the best academic reputation in the city. The intellectual rigor of the Jesuits was legendary and fascinating to me, and I felt that I needed to know all I could about international affairs and that somehow I would absorb all I could learn about domestic issues just by being in Washington in the mid-60s. I thought I would get in because I was fourth in my class of 327, my College Board scores were pretty good, and Georgetown tried to have at least one student from every state, an early affirmative action program. Still, I was worried. I had decided that if I got turned down at Georgetown, I'd go to the University of Arkansas, which had an open admissions policy for Arkansas high school graduates, and where the smart money said aspiring politicians should go anyway. In the second week of April, my acceptance notice from Georgetown arrived. I was happy, but by then I'd begun to question the wisdom of going. I didn't get a scholarship, and it was so expensive, $1,200 for tuition and $700 for room and fees, plus books, food, and other expenses. Although we were a comfortable middle-class family by Arkansas standards, I was worried that my folks couldn't afford it. And I was worried about being so far away and leaving Mother and Roger alone with Daddy, though age was slowing him down. My guidance counselor, Edith Irons, was adamant that I should go, that it was an investment in my future that my parents should make. Mother and Daddy agreed. Also, Mother was convinced that once I got there and proved myself, I'd get some financial help. So I decided to give it a shot. I graduated from high school on the evening of May 29, 1964, in a ceremony at Rick's Field, where we played our football games. As fourth-ranked student, I got to give the benediction. Subsequent court decisions on religion in public schools, had they been law then, might have taken us prayer leaders off the program. I agree that tax money should not be used to advance purely religious causes, but I was honored to get in the last word at the end of my high school years. My benediction reflected my deep religious convictions as well as a little politics, as I prayed that God would leave within us the youthful idealism and moralism which have made our people strong, sicken us at the sight of apathy, ignorance, and rejection, so that our generation will remove complacency, poverty, and prejudice from the hearts of free men, make us care so that we will never know the misery and muddle of life without purpose, and so that when we die, others will still have the opportunity to live in a free land. I know that some non-religious people may find all this offensive or naive, but I'm glad I was so idealistic back then, and I still believe every word I prayed. After graduation, I went with Moria Jackson to our senior party at the old Belvedere Club, not far from our Park Avenue house. Since Moria and I were both unattached at the time and had been in grade school together at St. John's, it seemed like a good idea, and it was. The next morning, I headed into my last summer as a boy. It was a typical good, hot Arkansas summer, and it passed quickly, with a sixth and final trip to the university band camp and a return to Boys State as a counselor. That summer I helped Daddy for a couple of weeks with the annual inventory at Clinton Buick, something I had done a few times before. It's hard to remember today when records are computerized and parts can be ordered from efficient distribution centers that in those days we kept parts in stock for cars more than 10 years old and counted them all by hand every year. The small parts were in little cubby holes in very tall shelves set close together, making the back of the parts department very dark, in stark contrast to the bright showroom in the front, which was only large enough to accommodate one of the new Buicks. The work was tedious, but I liked doing it, mostly because it was the only thing I did with Daddy. I also enjoyed being at the Buick place, visiting with Uncle Raymond, with the salesman on the car lot full of new and used cars, and with the mechanics in the back. There were three men back there I especially liked. Two were black. Early Arnold looked like Ray Charles and had one of the greatest laughs I ever heard. He was always wonderful to me. James White was more laid back. He had to be. He was trying to raise eight kids on what Uncle Raymond was paying him and what his wife Erlene earned by working at our house for Mother after Mrs. Walters left. I lapped up James's armchair philosophy. Once, when I remarked on how quickly my high school years had flown by, he said, "Yeah, time's going by so fast I can't hardly keep up with my age." Then I thought it was a joke. Now it's not so funny. The white guy, Ed Fauci, was a genius with cars and later opened his own shop. When I went away to school, we sold him the Henry J. I drove, one of six badly burned cars Daddy had repaired at the Buick dealership in Hope. I hated to part with that car, leaking hydraulic brakes and all, and I'd give anything to get it back now. It gave my friends and me a lot of good times, and one not-so-good one. One night, I was driving out of Hot Springs on Highway 7 on slick pavement, just behind a black car. As we were passing Jesse Howe's drive-in, the car in front stopped dead in its tracks, apparently to see what was showing on the big screen. One of its brake lights was out, and I didn't see it stop until it was too late. The combination of inattention, slow reflexes, and iffy brakes plowed me right into the back of the black car, driving my jaw into the steering wheel, which promptly broke in half. Luckily, no one was seriously hurt, and I had insurance to cover the other car's damage. The guys at Clinton Buick fixed the Henry J as good as new, and I was grateful that the steering wheel had broken instead of my jaw. It didn't hurt any worse than when Henry Hill had slugged me a few years earlier, and not nearly as badly as when the Ram had almost butted me to death. By then, I was more philosophical about such things, with an attitude rather like the wise man who said, "It does a dog good to have a few fleas now and then. It keeps him from worrying so much about being a dog." Chapter 9. The summer ended too quickly, as all childhood summers do, and on September 12th, Mother and I flew to Washington, where we would spend a week sightseeing before I started freshman orientation. I didn't know exactly what I was getting into, but I was full of anticipation. The trip was harder on Mother than on me. We were always close, and I knew that when she looked at me, she often saw both me and my father. She had to be worried about how she was going to raise little Roger and deal with big Roger without me to help out on both fronts. And we were going to miss each other. We were enough alike and enough different that we enjoyed being together. My friends loved her too, and she loved having them at our house. That would still happen, but usually only when I was home at Christmas or in the summer. I couldn't have known then, as I know now, how much she worried about me. Recently, I came across a letter she wrote in December 1963 as part of my successful application for the Elks Leadership Award, which was given to one or two high school seniors each year in towns with Elks clubs. She wrote that her letter relieves in a small way a guilt complex that I have about Bill. Anesthesia is my profession, and it has always taken time that I felt rightfully belonged to him. And because of this, the credit for what he is and what he has done with his life actually belongs to him. Thus, when I look at him, I see a self-made man. Was she ever wrong about that? It was she who taught me to get up every day and keep going, to look for the best in people even when they saw the worst in me, to be grateful for every day and greet it with a smile, to believe I could do or be anything I put my mind to, if I were willing to make the requisite effort, to believe that, in the end, love and kindness would prevail over cruelty and selfishness. Mother was not conventionally religious then, though she grew to be as she aged. She saw so many people die that she had a hard time believing in life after death. But if God is love, she was a godly woman. How I wish I'd told her more often that I was the furthest thing in the world from a self-made man. Despite all the apprehension about the big changes in our lives, Mother and I were both giddy with excitement by the time we got to Georgetown. Just a couple of blocks away from the main campus was the so-called East Campus, which included the School of Foreign Service and other schools that had women and were religiously and racially more diverse. The school was founded in 1789, George Washington's first year as president, by Archbishop John Carroll. A statue of him anchors the grand circle at the entrance to the main campus. In 1815, President James Madison signed a bill granting Georgetown a charter to confer degrees. Although our university has from the beginning been open to people of all faiths, and one of the greatest Georgetown presidents, Father Patrick Healy, was from 1874 to 1882 the first African-American president of a predominantly white university, the yard was all male, almost all Catholic, and all white. The School of Foreign Service was founded in 1919 by Father Edmund A. Walsh, a staunch anti-communist, and when I got there, the faculty was still full of professors who had fled from or suffered from communist regimes in Europe and China, and who were sympathetic to any anti-communist activity by the U.S. government, including in Vietnam. The politics weren't all that was conservative at the Foreign Service School. So was the curriculum, the rigor of which reflected the Jesuit educational philosophy, the ratio studiorum, developed in the late 16th century. For the first 2 years, 6 courses a semester were required, totaling 18 or 19 hours of class time, and there were no electives until the second semester of the junior year. Then there was the dress code. In my freshman year, men were still required to wear dress shirt, jacket and tie to class. Synthetic fabric drip-dry shirts were available, but they felt awful. So I went to Georgetown determined to fit the $5 a week dry cleaning bill for 5 shirts into my $25 a week allowance for food and other expenses. And there were the dorm rules. Freshmen are required to be in their rooms and studying weeknights and must have their lights out by midnight. On Friday and Saturday evenings, freshmen must return to their rooms for the night by 12:30 a.m. Absolutely no guests of the opposite sex, alcoholic beverages, pets, or firearms are allowed in the university dormitories. I know things have changed a bit since then, but when Hillary and I took Chelsea to Stanford in 1997, it was still somewhat unsettling to see the young women and men living in the same dorm. Apparently, the NRA hasn't yet succeeded in lifting the firearms restriction. One of the first people I met when Mother and I went through the front gate was the priest in charge of freshman orientation, Father Deneen, who greeted me by saying Georgetown couldn't figure out why a Southern Baptist with no foreign language except Latin would want to go to the Foreign Service School. His tone indicated that they also couldn't quite figure out why they had let me in. I just laughed and said maybe we'd figure it out together in a year or two. I could tell Mother was concerned, so after Father Deneen went on to other students, I told her that in a little while they'd all know why. I suspect I was bluffing, but it sounded good. After the preliminaries, we went off to find my dorm room and meet my roommate. Loyola Hall is at the corner of 35th and N Streets, just behind the Walsh Building, which houses the Foreign Service School and is connected to it. I was assigned room 225, which was right over the front entrance on 35th and overlooked the house and beautiful garden of Rhode Island's distinguished Senator Claiborne Pell, who was still in the Senate when I became president. He and his wife Nuala became friends of Hillary's and mine, and 30 years after staring at the exterior of their grand old house, I finally saw the inside of it. When Mother and I got to the door of my dorm room, I was taken aback. The 1964 presidential campaign was in full swing, and there, plastered on my door, was a Goldwater sticker. I thought I'd left them all behind in Arkansas. It belonged to my roommate, Tom Campbell, an Irish Catholic from Huntington, Long Island. He came from a staunch conservative Republican family and had been a football player at Xavier Jesuit High School in New York City. His father was a lawyer who won a local judgeship running on the conservative party line. Tom was probably more surprised than I was by his assigned roommate. I was the first Southern Baptist from Arkansas he'd ever met, and to make matters worse, I was a hardcore Democrat for LBJ. Mother wasn't about to let a little thing like politics stand in the way of good living arrangements. She started talking to Tom as if she'd known him forever, just as she always did with everyone, and before long, she won him over. I liked him too and figured we could make a go of it. And we have, through 4 years of living together at Georgetown and almost 40 years of friendship. Soon enough, Mother left me with a cheerful, stiff upper lip parting, and I began to explore my immediate surroundings, beginning with my dorm floor. I heard music coming from down the hall. Tara's theme from Gone with the Wind and followed it, expecting to find another Southerner, if not another Democrat. When I came to the room where the music was playing, I found instead a character who defied categories, Tommy Kaplan. He was sitting in a rocking chair, the only one on our floor. I learned that he was an only child from Baltimore, that his father was in the jewelry business, and that he had known President Kennedy. He spoke with an unusual clipped accent that sounded aristocratic to me, told me he wanted to be a writer, and regaled me with Kennedy tales. Though I knew I liked him, I couldn't have known then that I had just met another person who would prove to be one of the best friends I'd ever had. In the next 4 years, Tommy would introduce me to Baltimore, to his home on Maryland's eastern shore, to the Episcopal Church and its liturgy, in New York to the Pierre Hotel and its great Indian curry, to the Carlisle Hotel and my first experience with expensive room service, and to the 21 Club, where several of us celebrated his 21st birthday, and to Massachusetts and Cape Cod, where I nearly drowned after failing to hold on to a barnacle-covered rock in an effort that shredded my hands, arms, chest, and legs. Trying desperately to get back to shore, I was saved by a fortuitous long, narrow sandbar and a helping hand from Tommy's old-school friend, Fife Symington, later Republican governor of Arizona. If he could have foreseen the future, he might have had second thoughts. In return, I introduced Tommy to Arkansas, Southern folkways, and grassroots politics. I think I made a good trade. Over the next several days, I met other students and started classes. I also figured out how to live on $25 a week. $5 came off the top for the required 5 dress shirts, and I decided to eat on a dollar a day, Monday through Friday, and allocate another dollar to weekend meals so that I'd have $14 left to go out on Saturday night. In 1964, I could actually take a date to dinner for $14, sometimes a movie too, though I had to let the girl order first to make sure our combined order plus a tip didn't go over my budget. Back then, there were a lot of good restaurants in Georgetown where $14 would go that far. Besides, in the first few months, I didn't have a date every Saturday, so I was often a little ahead on my budget. It wasn't too hard to get by on a dollar a day the rest of the time. I always felt I had plenty of money, even enough to cover the extra cost of a school dance or some other special event.
End of Disc 3. Disc 4.
I always felt I had plenty of money, even enough to cover the extra cost of a school dance or some other special event. At Wise Miller's Deli, just across 36th Street from the Walsh Building, where most of my classes were, I got coffee and 2 donuts for 20 cents every morning. The first time in my life I ever drank coffee, a habit I still try to lick now and then, with limited success. At lunch, I splurged to 30 cents. Half of it bought a Hostess fried pie, apple or cherry. The other half went for a 16-ounce Royal Crown Cola. I loved those RCs and was really sad when they quit producing them. Dinner was more expensive, 50 cents. I usually ate at the Hoya carryout a couple of blocks from our dorm, which despite its name had a counter where you could enjoy your meal. Eating there was half the fun. For 15 cents, I got another big soft drink, and for 35 cents, a great tuna fish sandwich on rye, so big you could barely get your mouth around it. For 85 cents, you could get a roast beef sandwich just as big. Once in a while, when I hadn't blown the whole $14 the previous Saturday night, I would get one of those. But the real attractions of the Hoya carryout were the proprietors, Don and Rose. Don was a husky character with a tattoo on one of his bulging biceps, back when tattoos were a rarity rather than a common sight on the bodies of rock stars, athletes, and hip young people. Rose had a big beehive hairdo, a nice face, and a great figure, which she showed off to good effect in tight sweaters, tighter pants, and spiked heels. She was a big draw for boys with small budgets and large imaginations. And Don's good-natured but vigilant presence guaranteed that all we did was eat. When Rose was at work, we ate slowly enough to ensure good digestion. In my first 2 years, I rarely ventured beyond the confines of the university and its immediate surroundings, a small area bordered by M Street and the Potomac River to the south, Q Street to the north, Wisconsin Avenue to the east, and the university to the west. My favorite haunts in Georgetown were the Tombs, a beer hall and a cellar below the 1789 restaurant where most of the students went for beer and burgers, Billy Martin's restaurant with good food and atmosphere within my budget, and the cellar door just down the hill from my dorm on M Street. It had great live music. I heard Glenn Yarborough, a popular 60s folk singer, the great jazz organist Jimmy Smith, and a now-forgotten group called the Mugwumps, who broke up shortly after I came to Georgetown. Two of the men formed a new, more famous band, the Lovin' Spoonful, and the lead singer, Cass Elliott, became Mama Cass of the Mamas and the Papas. Sometimes the cellar door opened on Sunday afternoon, when you could nurse a Coke and listen to the Mugwumps for hours for just a dollar. Though occasionally I felt cooped up in Georgetown, most days I was happy as a clam, absorbed in my classes and friends. However, I was also grateful for my trips out of the cocoon. Several weeks into my first semester, I went to the Lisner Auditorium to hear Judy Collins sing. I can still see her standing alone on the stage with her long blonde hair, floor-length cotton dress, and guitar. From that day on, I was a huge Judy Collins fan. In December 1978, Hillary and I were on a brief vacation to London after the first time I was elected governor. One day as we window shopped down King's Road in Chelsea, the loudspeaker of a store blared out Judy's version of Joni Mitchell's Chelsea Morning. We agreed on the spot that if we ever had a daughter, we'd call her Chelsea. Though I didn't leave the Georgetown environs often, I did manage two trips to New York my first semester. I went home with Tom Campbell to Long Island for Thanksgiving. LBJ had won the election by then, and I enjoyed arguing politics with Tom's father. I goaded him one night by asking if the nice neighborhood they lived in had been organized under a protective covenant under which homeowners committed not to sell to members of proscribed groups, usually blacks. They were common until the Supreme Court ruled them unconstitutional. Mr. Campbell said yes, the area they lived in had been established under a covenant, but it ran not against blacks but Jews. I lived in a southern town with two synagogues and a fair number of anti-Semites who referred to Jews as Christ killers, but I was surprised to find anti-Semitism alive and well in New York. I guess I should have been reassured to know the South didn't have a corner on racism or anti-Semitism, but I wasn't. A few weeks before the Thanksgiving trip, I got my first bite at the Big Apple when I traveled to New York City with the Georgetown Band, pretty much a ragtag outfit. We practiced only once or twice a week, but we were good enough to be invited to play a concert at a small Catholic school, St. Joseph's College for Women in Brooklyn. The concert went fine, and at the mixer afterward, I met a student who invited me to walk her home and have a Coke with her and her mother. It was my first foray into one of the endless apartment buildings that housed the vast majority of New Yorkers, poor to rich. There was no elevator, so we had to walk up several flights to reach her place. It seemed so small to me then, accustomed as I was to Arkansas one-story houses with yards, even for people of modest means. All I remember about the encounter is that the girl and her mother seemed incredibly nice, and I was amazed that you could develop such outgoing personalities living in such confined spaces. After I said goodnight, I was on my own in the big city. I hailed a cab and asked to go to Times Square. I had never seen so many bright neon lights. The place was loud, fast, and throbbing with life, some of it on the seamy side. I saw my first streetwalker hitting on a hapless archetype, a pathetic-looking guy wearing a dark suit, crew-cut, and thick black horn-rimmed glasses and carrying a briefcase. He was both tempted and terrified. Terror won out. He walked on, she smiled, shrugged, and went back to work. I checked out the theaters and storefronts, and one bright sign caught my eye. Tad's Steaks, advertising big steaks for $1.59. It seemed too good to pass up, so I went in, got my steak, and found a table. Sitting near me were an angry boy and his heartbroken mother. He was giving her a verbal beating with the words, "It's cheap, Mama, it's cheap." She kept saying the salesman had told her it was nice. Over the next few minutes, I pieced the story together. She had saved up enough money to buy her son a record player that he wanted badly. The problem was that it was a standard high-fidelity system called Hi-Fi, but he wanted one of the new stereo systems that had much better sound and apparently more status among fashion-conscious kids. With all her scrimping, his mother couldn't afford it. Instead of being grateful, the kid was screaming at her in public, "Everything we have is cheap. I wanted a nice one." It made me sick. I wanted to slug him, to scream back at him that he was lucky to have a mother who loved him so much, who put food on his plate and clothes on his back with what was almost certainly a deadly dull job that paid too little. I got up and walked out in disgust without finishing my bargain steak. That incident had a big impact on me. I guess because of what my own mother had done and endured. It made me more sensitive to the daily struggles of women and men who do things we want someone else to do but don't want to pay much for. It made me hate ingratitude more and resolve to be more grateful myself. And it made me even more determined to enjoy life's lucky breaks without taking them too seriously, knowing that one turn of fate's screw could put me back to square one or worse. Not long after I got back from New York, I left the band to concentrate on my studies and student government. I won the election for freshman class president in one of my better campaigns, waged to an electorate dominated by Irish and Italian Catholics from the East. I don't remember how I decided to go for it, but I had a lot of help and it was exciting. There were really no issues and not much patronage, so the race boiled down to grassroots politics and one speech. One of my campaign workers wrote me a note showing the depth of our canvassing. "Bill, problems in New Mens, Hanover picking up lots of votes. There are possibilities on 3rd, Palin's floor, Loyola. Down at the end towards the payphone? Thanks to Dick Hayes. See you tomorrow. Sleep well, gentlemen. King." King was John King, a 5'5" dynamo who became the coxswain on the Georgetown crew team and study partner of our classmate Lucy Johnson, the president's daughter, who once invited him to dinner at the White House, earning our admiration and envy. On the Tuesday before the election, the class gathered to hear our campaign speeches. I was nominated by Bob Billingsley, a gregarious New Yorker whose Uncle Sherman had owned the Stork Club and who told me great stories of all the stars who had come there from the 20s on. Bob said I had a record of leadership and was a person who will get things done and done well. Then came my turn. I raised no issue and promised only to serve in whatever capacity is needed at any time, whether I won or lost, and to give the election a spirit which will make our class a little bit stronger and a little bit prouder when the race is over. It was a modest effort, as it should have been. As the saying goes, I had much to be modest about. The stronger of my two opponents tried to inject some gravity into an inherently weightless moment when he told us he was running because he didn't want our class to fall into the bottomless abyss of perdition. I didn't know much about that. It sounded like a place you'd go for collaborating with communists. This bottomless remark was over the top and was my first big break. We worked like crazy and I was elected. After the votes were counted, my friends collected a lot of nickels, dimes, and quarters so that I could call home on the nearest payphone and tell my family I had won. It was a happy conversation. I could tell there was no trouble on the other end of the line, and Mother could tell I was getting over my homesickness. Though I enjoyed student government, the trips to New York, and just being in the Georgetown area, my classes were the main event of my freshman year. For the first time, I had to work to learn. I had one big advantage. All 6 of my courses were taught by interesting, able people. We all had to study a foreign language. I chose German because I was interested in the country and impressed by the clarity and precision of the language. Dr. von Eyring, the German professor, was a kindly man who had hidden from the Nazis in the loft of a farmhouse after they began burning books, including the children's books he wrote. Arthur Cozens, the geography professor, had a white goatee and a quaint professional manner. I was bored in his class until he told us that, geologically, Arkansas was one of the most interesting places on Earth, because of its diamond, quartz, crystal, bauxite, and other mineral deposits and formations. I took logic from Otto Hentz, a Jesuit who had not yet been ordained as a priest. He was bright, energetic, and concerned about the students. One day he asked me if I'd like to have a hamburger with him for dinner. I was flattered and agreed, and we drove up Wisconsin Avenue to a Howard Johnson's. After a little small talk, Otto turned serious. He asked me if I'd ever considered becoming a Jesuit. I laughed and replied, "Don't I have to become a Catholic first?" When I told him I was a Baptist and said, only half in jest, that I didn't think I could keep the vow of celibacy even if I were a Catholic, he shook his head and said, "I can't believe it. I've read your papers and exams. You write like a Catholic. You think like a Catholic." I used to tell this story to Catholic groups on the campaign trail in Arkansas, assuring them that I was the closest thing they could get to a Catholic governor.